Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with best-selling author Jen Lancaster, whose new book is Here I Go Again. We'll also talk with Yuka Petz, whose beautiful work appears in a new exhibit at the Carroll Art Gallery at the Woldenberg Arts Center at Tulane University. And celebrating Super Bowl weekend, we'll be talking with former Saints cornerback Reggie Jones, whose new book is Stilettos on Gridiron. Jen Lancaster is a New York Times bestselling author who cracks me up. She's lived out the fantasies of every woman who's ever been laid off in her first memoir, Bitter is the New Black, Confessions of a Condescending, Egomaniacal, Self-Centered Smartass, or Why You Should Never Carry a Prada Bag to the Unemployment Office. Several more followed, including Such a Pretty Fat and Pretty in Plaid. Then Jen turned to fiction. In her first novel, If You Were Here, she chronicles the misadventures of a young couple who purchased their dream house, which turns into a nightmare. Now she's back with Here I Go Again, which explores that age-old fantasy of what it's like to have a second chance at high school, thanks to time travel. Jen Lancaster, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so excited you're coming to town. You live large and hilariously in your fiction, just as you do in your life. So what made you think of that return to high school for Here I Go Again?
I think everybody in their life looks back at mistakes that they've made and they've wanted a do-over. So in Here I Go Again, I really wanted to explore that. And to step back for a minute, my first book was If You Were Here. And that book actually started off as a memoir. I wanted to write about the experience of buying and remodeling a home. And as we started the process, I realized my husband and I would get divorced or end up on the news. So I turned that to fiction. So in If You Were Here, a lot of what's happening with the characters really closely paralleled what was happening in my own life. And the critics loved it, and it sold really well to a new audience. But it made my fans mad because they couldn't figure out where the fiction ended and where the reality began. So I wanted to do something entirely different from my second book so people would know that this character is not me, which is how I came up with the idea of going back to high school and time travel, because clearly that is not something I'm able to do.
Well, it's a common fantasy, though. We've all got it. Now, tell us about your love of Whitesnake, the band that looms large in this novel.
Isn't it great? I love the title, Here I Go Again. Well, back in the day, I mean, I was in high school and college when hair metal was the thing. And I have to be honest with you, I hated it. I was into new wave and alternative, and I loved George Michael. So these scary guys in leather pants were so not for me. So as part of the journey of not writing a book about myself, I wanted to give the character Lissy entirely different interests. I love the idea of Here I Go Again, so I wanted to fit Whitesnake into it. And I started listening to their music, and every time my husband would go by my office, he would catch me watching different stuff on YouTube, and he would be just so confused, like, are you listening to Pantera? So now, 20 years after the fact, this is my favorite music now. I'm walking around here like I discovered it, when we can just go down to the basement, and every Motley Crue CD that was ever made is down there from when my husband listened to it 20, 25 years ago.
I wonder, you are so funny. You're so funny in your fiction, and you're so funny in your memoirs. Do you just sit there and laugh all the time while you're writing, or do you ever have those terribly dark days when it's hard for you to summon up a sense of humor?
Absolutely, but humor is what helps me deal with things. If I'm ever in a situation that's sad or scary, I try to find something that I can hold on to that's funny. My husband and I have been through some dark times. That's actually how I got my start writing. He and I had both been laid off from our executive jobs, and he was in the throes of depression. We couldn't afford his medicine, and things were bad. But I had to find a way to make it funny because I had to deal with everything for both of us. And to amuse myself, since we didn't have anything else to do, I started writing down my stories of being rejected for jobs and having the power turned off and figuring out how you can live without gas service. So I made it funny, and I put it online, and all of these other people identified with what I was saying. And then I realized, hey, I'm onto something. I think I've always been funny, but when I was a kid, I think my parents thought it was just disrespectful.
Well, maybe so, you know, but readers do love it. I think Bitter is the New Black is one of the funniest books I've read in so, so long.
Thank you. That seems to be everybody's favorite. I'm not sure I can ever recapture that voice, because when I wrote that book, there were no stakes. There were no consequences. There was no audience. It was just me and a Microsoft Word document spilling out everything I ever thought.
Well, we're still reading, though, which is good. Now, a lot of the stories in your book are about the relationships between women, which are so fraught. And there is, of course, in the return to high school, that risk of going back to the Mean Girls era.
You know, I didn't have the worst experience in high school in the world with Mean Girls. I wasn't a mean girl, and I wasn't popular. I was in a group that was kind of left alone. I was a nerd. People may have felt sorry for me, so I formed my own crowd within the drama club and the speech team, and we thought we were super cool, but looking back on it, we really were nerds. I think my strategy in high school was to stay under the radar, and now I wonder if I wouldn't do things differently, you know, if I had the chance to do it again.
So tell us about Lissy's dilemma in Here I Go Again.
Lissy is a fun character. She's so hateful in the beginning that nobody wants to root for her, because she says everything she thinks, and nothing she says is actually very nice. So, I mean, everybody dealt with mean girls in high school. What I think is so fun about Here I Go Again is that I figure out the roots of what makes a mean girl. Basically, everybody is picked on by someone, and Lissy is ridden pretty hard by her mother, and that just makes her generally unpleasant. But the thing is, she's funny. And I think people will eventually be won over by some of the outrageous things that she says, because everybody thinks things, not everybody says things, because they don't have to deal with the consequences from having said them. And Lissy's now dealing with the consequences of opening her mouth again and again and again.
And having lost everything, she has to go back to high school, to her reunion. And she is offered this extraordinary opportunity by an unexpected woman friend.
Yeah, the nerd in high school, the hippie spiritualist girl who she used to make fun of in high school for burning sage in the gym before basketball games, has turned into this new age healer who has quite a following. So the second that she offers Lissy a little comfort, a little solace, Lissy jumps on it, largely because she thinks, well, this will work out nicely for me. Because in Lissy's world, it is all about Lissy. And I think Diva is the most interesting character in the book.
Me too. I loved her. She's an adorable character.
Expect to see her again. I'm going to, my next novel is going to be about magical realism too. And Diva is going to be a running character through all the books because I can't give her up.
Oh, good.
I feel like in this book, Lissy went through her journey and then I'm done with her. But Diva is such an interesting foil that I can't not continue to use her.
And her journey can take her anywhere, which I love, love, love. Well, you can meet the fabulous and funny Jen Lancaster, who will probably be wearing her trademark pearls, Tuesday, January 29th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Jen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I first met Yuka Petz at the New Orleans Book Fair when she was exhibiting beautiful handmade books and paper ornaments, fragile and lovely things. Then I ran into her again at the book fair this year with more beautiful things made from paper, including a paper rosette honoring bookworms extraordinaire, made from the pages of books. They look like awards for reading. Now Yuka has work in an exhibit at the Newcomb College Carroll Gallery of Art, Black, White, and Things, which runs through January. Yuka, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, you are drawn to paper and books. This is your art form.
Absolutely.
How did you start with that?
I actually made my very first book when I was in third grade, and it was just a book report on In the Year of the Boar and Jackie Robinson with wrapping paper and cardboard covers, and that was it. I loved that I could take this object that exists all around me, but I could actually make it and own it. And so from there, I studied bookbinding at summer camp, and then that led to paper making, which led to graphic design and just a holistic view of book arts.
Now, you often make wonderful things from the pages of books. What kinds of things do you take into consideration when you're tearing a page out of a book, I have to ask?
Sure. I think that when you're deconstructing books for use in other projects, there are things to take into consideration, of course. I'm never going to destroy a valuable or historic record or, you know, other piece of archival material. I mean, I've worked in conservation. That would something I would never dream of doing. But I usually get books from library sales. So they're deaccessioned library books. And I generally favor foreign language books, so that particularly here in the U.S., we can focus more on the texture and the pattern, the way that the type sits on the page, as opposed to actually reading it, because I'm really interested in letter forms and text as a whole thing.
Tell us about those beautiful ornaments that you made from the pages of a Japanese dictionary.
Sure. In Japan, there's a traditional technique of using the decorative papers to cover eggs, and they'll make ornaments out of them, whether standing or hanging. And with my interest in text and books, I turned it on its head a little bit, and so I use pages from Japanese dictionaries, French novels, other foreign language books, and then I wrap the egg in them and coat them and seal them. So they're just lovely, perfect little text objects.
They're just so magical. You know, they're just magical little objects. Now, you have this beautiful piece in the exhibit at Newcomb called Motion Studies. That's just this gorgeous, free-flowing paper sculpture. Talk about that, would you?
I'd love to. Movement Studies is a piece that I did really in response to how text might move across a page and how our body moves when we write. So each piece is put together from individual pages of handmade paper, and each page is actually created while the handmade paper is wet. So I pull a fresh sheet of paper, and then I take graphite and a brush and I write on it, really thinking about how if letters are moving across a page, how are they interacting with each other? How do they move as a herd? And how does that movement affect the substrate? How does that affect the paper? And then I actually let the paper dry and kind of suggest to it how I want it to move, but it's a particular pulp that kind of shrinks a lot when it's drying, so I only can control it so much. I can suggest, but it kind of does its own thing, which I think is also responding to the graphite that's on the paper. And then it's one large installed piece that actually mimics the beginning stroke of a cursive writing. So it's that first kind of drop down and up.
Oh, it's so lovely. That curved line with those floating pages. It's just a magical thing when you walk into the room. And I love it. I love it. I see what you mean when you talk about that opening stroke now.
Thank you.
Perfect. And then you have another piece. Is it Iroha? Is that the way to pronounce it?
It's Iroha.
That is so almost a grid of characters.
Absolutely. Iroha is actually traditionally a pangram. It's a poem in Japanese that uses every character of the hiragana writing set. But again, I like to use foreign language sometimes so that we can step away from the letters and look at the movement and look at the mark making. So for Iroha, it uses every letter of the Japanese hiragana, but I'm really focusing on how your body's moving. I actually dipped my fingers in graphite and wrote every letter and kind of went back in and kind of shaped it some more. So I went over each page multiple times to create that movement and that sort of flow through the entire piece.
And in these days of computer keyboards, it's good to be reminded that writing is physical.
It is.
You know, making a text is work.
It is. It's absolutely physical. And I think that's the most interesting thing about text is that it's purely human construct. You know, other animals communicate, but text is totally human.
And making paper. That's smelly, wet work.
It can be. You know, commercial papermaking is certainly an odorous endeavor, but handmade paper, as long as you're working fresh, it's not terribly stinky. But it's definitely, it's wonderful to just get your hands into the pulp and pull the vat out and have the control while the paper's still wet before it's ever become a dried piece of paper. And to be able to manipulate it is really an amazing, amazing media to work with.
And your paper is so delicate and light and gorgeous. And you also have a small but lovely handmade book in this exhibit as well.
I do. That piece is called Shuji Renshu. So that kind of roughly translates to a calligraphy practice or calligraphy training. So when I was living in Japan, I was actually taking a local calligraphy class with my local community center. And when you're practicing calligraphy, you end up with a lot of waste sheets where you're writing the same thing over and over again. And I actually was looking at letter forms or Japanese character forms and broke them down on the different quadrants and then put them back together to kind of look at the positive and negative space and to really break down the strokes of each letter.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Well, I know you've grown up all over the world and you've studied papermaking and bookmaking all over the world. And you said that whenever you go to a new place, you seek out papermaking and bookmaking communities. How have you found that in New Orleans?
It's an exciting time to be in New Orleans in bookmaking and papermaking and printmaking as well. In New Orleans, it's getting organized, I think. Actually, a friend of mine, Angela Driscoll, and I, we co-founded an interdisciplinary arts organization called SIFT, which stands for Sequence, Image, Form, and Text. And that really starts from the book arts and spreads outward. So we're hoping to help bring that community together even more.
Oh, that's great. The Newcomb Gallery is open from 9 to 4, Monday through Friday, and Black, White, and Things, the exhibit, runs through February 6. For more information about Yuka's beautiful work, check out Yuka Pets, that's YUKAPETZ.com. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a big Super Bowl weekend in New Orleans, so we're especially pleased to welcome former Saints cornerback Reggie Jones to The Reading Life. Reggie played for New Orleans from 1991 to 1994 and has taken his NFL experience into his business, Fit to Win and RJ Speaks. He's a keynote and motivational speaker who's based in Memphis, but he's here today to talk about his new book, Stilettos on Gridiron, Women Getting a Feel for the Game with former NFL player Reginald Reggie Jones. Welcome, Reggie.
Susan, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on The Reading Life.
My pleasure to be here. Always good to be back in New Orleans.
I thought your first book was going to be about fitness and wellness, and here you are taking on the battle of the sexes. You're a brave man.
I am brave. Keep in mind, nobody plays the cornerback position unless you're brave. That's, you know, the most daring position on the field.
So is there a lady somewhere who motivated you to write this book? What makes you think women don't understand football?
I actually wasn't married to my wife while I was playing, and for sure, she doesn't understand football. She's looking forward to reading the book.
Can this marriage be saved?
She's very much looking forward to reading the book. She does not understand football.
Well, I hope it's dedicated to her at the very least.
She got a dedication, but certainly I had the masses in mind when I came up with the concept.
So what is it you think women need to know about football?
Well, I'm not so presumptuous as to think that I should suggest women in general need to know about football. This book is written for women who are interested in learning about football, women who don't know football, who want to know it. So I'm not suggesting for those loyal, diehard female fans out there who understand the game that they should pick up the book. Only those who feel intrigued and feel that they need some help. That's what this book is for, those who are looking for help. One of the things that I made a point in doing with this book, I did not want to talk X's and O's, and I wanted to stay away from rules of the game. So my perspective was to deal with it from the concepts and components. That's the angle that I took. I wanted to help women get a grasp of the concepts of the game and the different components and different facets. So there's quite a bit to learn in that regard.
So give us an example of one of your key concepts.
Well, I talk about, you know, different phases of the game. Well, first of all, I don't think every woman who watches or goes to the game knows that there are three teams within one team. You know, you have the offensive team, the defensive team, and the special teams. And whereas many women probably are familiar with offensive players and defensive players, maybe there are quite a few who aren't familiar with special teams players. So in those various chapters, I break down the different players and positions within those teams. So you have three teams within one, and then I describe the players and the positions within each of those teams. And then I talk about how valuable those teams are with regards to offensive teams. They're generally expected to be the scorers, producing points. The defensive team is generally expected to defend the opponent and stop scoring. And the special teams kind of have two hats that they wear. They're expected to put the team in good field position. And also, they produce some scoring by way of the kicker and field goal kicking and extra point kicking. And sometimes a good punt return for a touchdown or a kickoff return for a touchdown. So I discuss these things in detail.
Okay, you're making me feel pretty good so far. I knew that. So what was it like for you to break it down, to break down the game? You didn't put on your stilettos to write this book, I know.
Figuratively, I did, because I wanted to make sure, I was hoping that I would be reaching women in a tone that they would be receptive to. Since I've been out of the game, I still love the game. It took a few years to adjust to not playing, but after that, I watch every game on Sunday and Monday, and I'm still very closely connected to the game. But this is my way of sharing my passion. I still very much love the game, and I'm always analyzing as I watch. So I kind of take the analyst perspective.
Was it interesting for you to go back and break it down into the basics?
It was quite interesting. Like I said, I'm very passionate about the game. So for me, it was kind of sharing my passion with those who are developing a passion for the game. Because one of the things that fascinated me before I decided to write the book, interestingly enough, I considered for 5 years in my head, wondering why no player coach had ever written a book to help women understand it, that being a specific group, because I realized in 2010 when the NFL launched female apparel that there's something to this market. So I did the research and found out that 40% of the NFL fan base is now women. That was fascinating to me. So I said, okay, no longer figuring or wondering why no one else has done this book, I better do it. There's a market.
So what do you think men hate most about sharing football with the women in their lives?
Just a low level of patience. Men are so obsessed with the game, they feel they can't miss a single play, a single moment, because you know the excitement of the game. No one knows when that big touchdown or that big score, that big hit is going to take place. So men just don't have the patience to explain. And I actually make reference to that in my introduction, that, you know, whether this book is for women who they're closely connected with someone, whether it's a significant other, a relative, or their mates, and they just feel they don't have time or no interest in answering questions during a game. In some cases, these men won't answer any questions during the season, so they're not serious about it.
That's true. So,
but I think it's a lack of patience, and they feel that they're going to miss something if they answer a question that possibly could take 30 seconds to answer. But
right.
They feel like they're going to miss something.
So if a woman really knows nothing about football and her boyfriend takes her to a Saints game, should she fake it? Should she fake it, or should she just go and get the beer? What do you think?
Well, I think most of them will go and get the beer. Now, if you go to the Saints game, if nothing else, they will enjoy the crowd and they will enjoy people watching. And if they so feel compelled, they can enjoy dancing with the crowd, because I make reference to this in the book as well. The Saints fans, no doubt, are the best dancing fans in the league.
All right. All right.
There's no question about that. If you're going to stand up and get crunk, you're pretty brave.
Amen. So what's it like for you to come back to New Orleans for the Super Bowl?
Well, I'm ecstatic. I'll tell you, you know, part of this project also was stimulated by the notion that New Orleans would be hosting again, and this whole thing about this still being the process of New Orleans making the great comebacks, this Katrina, you know, that's still moving. But for me, as a former Saints player and an NFL player, for New Orleans, who I consider second home, to be hosting the Super Bowl, I thought, if I'm ever going to write a football book, what better place to release it than in the city of New Orleans during Super Bowl week?
Well, we're glad you decided to do that. So you'll be debuting your book next week. You'll be visiting Children's Hospital. And have you got any book signings set up we should know about?
These book signings are quite interesting. I'm actually doing 6 book signings around the city. And actually, it's probably better served for your listeners to tune in to my website. They can go to www.reginald-reggie-jones.com and get the specific times and locations. Because, you know, whereas I did the release at Hudson News Bookstore in the airport on Sunday the 27th, I'm moving around the city. I'll be going to both Barnes & Nobles. So we're finalizing the times, but I'll be at the Barnes & Nobles on Veterans in Metairie. And I'll do the one in the West Bank as well. I'll be signing also at Atascocket. And again, we're finalizing times. I'll be at the Sheraton, and I'll be at the Hyatt. So I'll be moving around, but it's probably best to go to the website for the final dates and times.
Okay, we'll direct folks there. We've been talking with former Saints cornerback Reggie Jones, whose new book is Stilettos on Gridiron, Women Getting a Feel for the Game with former NFL player Reginald Reggie Jones. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great time while you're here.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Lunch and Lit Group discusses The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander and Cornel West, Tuesday, January 29th at noon at the Keller Library Community Center. Today's guest, Jen Lancaster, signs her book, Here I Go Again, Tuesday, January 29th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Historian Larry Powell discusses and signs The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans, Wednesday, January 30th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Edward Bramley signs Legendary Locals of New Orleans, Thursday, January 31st at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Friday, February 1st at 6 p.m. at the New Orleans Museum of Art for a tour of the museum's library and art books in the collection. For more information, check out Women's National Book Association of New Orleans on Facebook or call 504-895-1629. Mickey Zimmerman signs Can I Get a Witness? 21 Frustrations of a Black Woman, Including Me, Saturday, February 2nd at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. The Poetry Buffet features readings by area poets, Saturday, February 2nd at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin by Eric Larson, Tuesday, February 5th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The 1718 Society, a student-run literary organization of Tulane, Loyola, and UNO students, continues their reading series Tuesday, February 5th at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel on St. Charles Avenue. February's featured reader is Josip Novakovich, author of the short story collection Infidelities. Looking for a writer's group? Barnes & Noble West Bank hosts one every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.